Before I get into the topic today, I also brought along a copy of the latest edition of Mental Health United States. So if you give me a card, I will see that you get the electronic version of this publication. This publication covers a whole range of mental health issues, from mental health epidemiology to service delivery to financing to performance indicators and so on. Not a novel, but useful reference material. So if you want one, please give me a card. Okay, so let me give a little bit of context to this session. Post-traumatic stress disorder really was not identified as something specific until the time of the Vietnam War. A lot of veterans from the Vietnam War came back and had a series of symptoms that eventually became classified as post-traumatic stress disorder by the American Psychiatric Association. In the early efforts to treat PTSD, there was a lot of work done on what was called debriefings. And one of the procedures of dealing with someone who's been through a trauma is to actually have them talk about the trauma. Well, in some cases, that works very well. In other cases, it doesn't. It may make the person worse. So there's been a lot then. As a result of that, there was a lot of work done by the Institute of Medicine in the 80s on post-traumatic stress disorder, and they came basically to the conclusion that it works in some cases and it doesn't work in others. So if you're interested in pursuing that, I would encourage you to read the work from that period. Then, more recently, the American Psychiatric Association has developed a new protocol treat PTSD. This protocol has been available for now almost a year, and it's in the phase of being implemented out in the field. And then even more recently, in last month's Archives of General Psychiatry, there was an article on the use of virtual support groups for people with PTSD. So there's a long history to this if you want to go and actually look at how the concept evolved, how the treatments evolved, the controversy over the treatments, and so on. Now, one other thing that should be added, talking about PTSD is not only applicable to returning vets from Vietnam, it's also applicable to people who were exposed to the 9/11 disaster in New York. It's applicable to people who have been through personal traumas. So in mental health, we now talk about trauma-informed care. So one of the things that should be looked at literally at everyone who comes in for care is whether they have experienced a trauma and what type of effect that trauma has had on them. And that may range from sexual abuse all the way up to participating in, you know, violence in Iraq. Today, I want to focus on returning vets and go through a number of overheads basically as a stimulating conversation and then have a discussion of this with you. So I appreciate you coming 8:30 on Wednesday morning. It's cold outside and we'll see what we can do here. Okay, so first on this issue, we became interested in the issue of PTSD and returning vets about a year ago, and we have prepared a series of white papers on this topic. So if you would like the white papers, give me your card and I'll see that you get the white papers. Some of this work has already been published in a journal called Archives of Psychiatric Nursing, and other of it has been published in another journal called Behavioral Health Care. Now, the issue for returning vets is the fact that we can expect 35% to 40% of the veterans who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who have been on the ground there, whether or not they've actually been in a combat situation, to be experiencing one or more of the types of disorders we want to talk about here, the primary one of which is PTSD. Now, if we translate that into numbers of people, there have been about 1.5 million people on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, so we do the arithmetic, and that would translate out somewhere between 450 and 500,000 people we can expect in this population among returnees to either be experiencing this problem when they return or to develop this problem after they return. So the numbers are very large. If you want to go through the full epidemiology of this, there is a report from the Department of Defense that was published on June 15th. It's the report of the mental health work group at the Department of Defense that lays out this epidemiology. So I'm not exaggerating the number, I'm using the Department of Defense number. Most of these people will suffer from PTSD, anxiety disorder, depression, and or some type of a substance use disorder or some other combination of these disorders when they return. Let's go ahead here. So if you are looking at this not from the level of a clinician but from the level of a system, what are some of the things you would want to do about this problem? And so in our white papers, we outline a whole strategy of how you would approach this problem systemically, and I want to quickly go through some of those steps to give you a sense of that. It seems to me, looking at this epidemiologically, one of the very first things you would want to do is actually know where all these vets, not just the 450 to 500,000, but as these people return, you would want to have some sense of where these people return to in the United States geographically. And I was amazed to find out when I asked that the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Defense don't have such a system. So when someone comes back and leaves the military, there is an address put into a record, but nobody compiles that information into a statistical picture of where these people have actually returned to. That's very meaningful because unlike previous wars where there was a draft, we now no longer have a draft, so the people who are leaving into this war and returning aren't equally distributed in the population. The people who are in Iraq and Afghanistan tend to be people who come from areas that have higher rates of poverty and are more rural. So if you go to places like Alabama and West Virginia, you have an overrepresentation of these people. If you go to some other states like Maryland, you have an underrepresentation of these people. So part of the first problem here is, where are veterans returning to? Where are National Guard and reservists returning to? And where are active duty military people returning to? And that really needs to be mapped out geographically, and then you need to begin applying geographical information systems to understanding the dynamics of those populations in general. Then within that, because the Department of Defense actually screens every single person now returning from Iraq and Afghanistan for mental illness and for substance use disorder, the data already exists to link data on assessments to the geographical distribution of this population, although the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration don't currently do that. So there's a huge epidemiological problem here that needs to be worked out. So assuming that you've worked that out and that you know where there are numbers of these people, then a next major step is actually outreaching to these groups to see what service needs they have, whether they understand the benefits that they're entitled to, and so on. And the Veterans Affairs Department is now in the process of doing that. They're beginning to issue contracts. Let me cite one of those. The Department of Veterans Affairs divides the United States into what are called VISNs. And VISNs are geographical areas that aren't totally coextensive with states, but represent population groups from which the Veterans Affairs Department manages the Veterans Affairs Service Delivery System, which comes basically through the VAMCs, the Veterans Affairs Medical Centers. The particular contract I'm thinking of is a contract that was issued by VISN 12, which is the Great Lakes region, which includes Chicago and the area north into southern Wisconsin. They said, we want three things. We believe we have 15,000 returnees. from Iraq and Afghanistan who come back here in the last year. Most of these people have had absolutely no contact with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Therefore, number one, we want a contractor to contact every one of these people and explain their veterans benefits to them. So that means basically making 15,000 phone calls to these people explaining the veterans benefits. Secondly, we believe about 8,500 of these people need mental health or substance abuse services. Therefore, when this first round of calls is done, we also want additional screening for these disorders. So that may imply continuation on the first call, or it may actually apply a second follow-up call that could theoretically be to a group as large as the 15,000 people. And then thirdly, we believe that after all this is done, you will identify 5,000 people of this 15,000 who need continuing mental health services. Therefore, we want a contractor who will provide telephonic mental health services for 3 years to this set of 5,000 people. So that's an example of where the Department of Veterans Affairs is going with this. And that's one model. So what they're basically saying there is they're using the kinds of numbers the Department of Defense generated to produce estimates, and from that they're then translating those estimates into potential contracts that would be issued through these visions to do this work by contractors. Now, as soon as you look at the problem that way, let's take the problem of the 5,000 people. That is a very large problem in terms of putting together a service network to serve the 5,000. So do all your arithmetic on that, which we did. You would find that you need a service network run through a distributed call center operation that had the capacity for 330 providers who would work 30 hours a week each, reaching that population of 5,000 people, at least in the initial six-month interval of the service. And then you could assume that this population would be decreasing over time, so we set it up so it would decrease each six-month period. So you go six months with the full 5,000, go the next 6 months with 4,500, and so on. So, sure, please. Very good question. It varies by the group. Let me say a little bit about that. If you are active duty military when you return and you remain active duty military, you are the responsibility of the Department of Defense to provide health care services, including mental health services and substance abuse services. If you are a reservist, so you are a reservist from a place, you were called up to active duty by the Secretary of Defense, you went there and served, you came back, and you've been deactivated, you are covered by the benefits of the Department of Defense. You are not covered by the benefits of the Veterans Administration. The third group is people who were active duty military who left the military and became veterans. They are covered by the Department of Veterans Affairs under current legislation. The fourth group is the National Guard units, the state National Guard units, virtually all of which have been in Iraq now. They currently have no federal benefits, so there's a huge effort underway in the Congress to get them federal benefits through the Department of Veterans Affairs. So it varies by group. So when I talk about the VA, I'm only talking about, in that contract, the group that would be served by the VA in VISN 12. There are many other people there, National Guard people, who may have these problems who are not eligible for the benefits currently.
That's not correct. National Guard members were activated on the 5-10. They will serve in operation of VA. Can get
health care. Under what circumstances?
You don't have to prove the connection to get that.
That's good to know, because I was under the impression that they were not currently. Senator Akaka and Senator Rockefeller are crafting legislation to expand those benefits under the assumption these people have inadequate benefits. Okay. Okay. That's a good correction. I'm glad you brought that. Okay, let me keep moving down here next. So if you don't go the way the VA designed, where you would design a telephonic system, how else might you do this? So we also built in some additional steps here. I said, well, one of the things you might want to consider doing is actually building a partnership between the DOD and the VA and the National Guard and state and local mental health and substance abuse services, some of which are operated through state governments and some of which are operated locally. And there are now beginning to emerge some examples, and I know this best, I guess, through the VA, where the VA has contracted with local providers, a local community mental health center, for example, to provide mental health services locally. But again, if you're going to take this problem on systemically, the first thing you need to do is map this whole thing nationally. So if you map the epidemiology, then you need to map the service availability and look at the congruence or non-congruence of these systems. And again, that has not been done to my knowledge. And I think what would be implied there is a whole set of new partnerships between VA and DOD with people that they have not traditionally worked with in the past. And speaking of, you know, having myself been a military veteran and also more recently having had a lot of discussions with them, I think those organizations are both very insular. They believe they should be able to solve their problems on their own and not require the use of entities in the community or not require the use of contractors. So they're going through a process of change themselves as we get into this. Now, a kind of a third level here. Let's say that you actually had the community services and these were publicly available. You would still, and you were able to penetrate this population to a certain level, you would still be left with people who need these services who are not going to use either VA services or public services that might be available in the community for many different reasons. So we added another step which said, well, one thing you might want to consider, and Vision 12, in effect, was doing this, the creation of a distributed call center, the purpose of which was be to allow people to call in to receive anonymized care. So you can call in any level of need, and we will respond to your need. You don't have to identify who you are. We're happy to work with you, etc. Now, in doing that, obviously, you need to know when the same person calls in, so you need to have a vehicle for identifying that person. It does not have to be the person's name, however. So that type of system is already beginning to be put in place. And then another step here, this is what was reported in the Archives of General Psychiatry in the October 2007 issue. Virtually everybody in these groups that's been over there are people who are very sophisticated in using the internet and email and instant messaging and so on. So we said, well, we think also because military veterans like to have contact with other military veterans and be served by other military veterans, that it would be a very good thing to create a virtual support group that people could participate in. And that support group could be either local or it could be national, but you would have people in there that you knew and could rely on and you could communicate with. And that support group could actually involve self-help elements. For example, there's a lot of work going on in the wellness community now. This is not relevant to vets, but relevant to wellness in other areas where the concepts of wellness and self-help could be applied in these support groups. And then finally, we also said in doing all of this, because many of these things have never been done and integrated together, you really need to put this together and demonstrate this and do an evaluation of this in one or more geographical areas. So that, in essence, is an approach that could be used to reaching out to the population that would be a systemic approach. You're coming at the problem from a system or a public health approach, as opposed to coming at the problem person by person clinically. Well, not completely. There are pieces of it beginning to be implemented and talked about, but the whole picture, the whole configuration has not been implemented, basically. And the DOD versus VA versus the National Guard, we did already talk a little bit about that. So in doing this work, another issue that comes up, the second bullet here, what is your unit of analysis? Is your unit of analysis going to be a state? Is your unit of analysis going to be a VA medical center? Is your unit of analysis going to be a returnee military unit? What is going to be your unit of analysis? And how you think of that will greatly color how you approach the problem. And again, depending on which piece of this problem you're looking at, if you're looking at VA services, you might answer that question differently than if you were looking at a returnee DOD unit. And then thirdly, we also think, and we've coined this concept, there's a need for what's called a fusion center. A fusion center would be a place where key people from DOD and the VA and the National Guard could actually sit down and discuss common issues without their organization necessarily feeling threatened by participating in the process. A lot of the issues here, I think, are bureaucratic issues between very large bureaucracies that don't work well together. So you need to create, in effect, a neutral ground where people can get together and have discussions of this. And one vehicle for doing that might be, again, to create a demonstration of some type in a state, as an example, and have a fusion center in that state so you could bring all three of those groups to the table from that particular state. And a potential example of that would be the state of West Virginia, or the state of Alabama, for that matter. Okay, now, having said that, I want to also now go on and talk a little bit about a whole range of projects that I think people like you would be interested in. You may not want to do service delivery, but you may want to do various kinds of research that would be associated with this kind of work. And the very first one goes back to where I started, the epidemiology and surveillance issue. How many vets have problems? How severe are the problems? And how are these vets distributed? And there's no place you can go right now to answer those three questions in an integrated way. There's not even anything on the radar from the National Institute of Mental Health or from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration or HRSA or any of these other places that is looking at that issue. And the point that I made before, the draftees versus volunteers, there's a high correlation between volunteers and poverty because going into the military, I think, is viewed as a vehicle of social mobility by the current generation of people who participate. I don't believe that the National Guard people ever thought they would be activated. They never went to the National Guard to be activated. They went to put in their 2 weeks in the summer and their weekend visits and to get a retirement after 20 years. So a lot of the assumptions that this system was based upon have been thrown out the window as a result of the Iraq War. Another whole area, large-scale analytical studies. Who is using what services with what effects? Because PTSD service is still controversial, the traditional debriefings are controversial, the new APA EBP protocol has not really been implemented out in the field. I think there's a huge opportunity to look at service implementation and service effectiveness and to begin this early on in the process so you can track this out over a very long period of time with population groups. One of the things that's been noted about PTSD in the Vietnam vet population, some Vietnam vets are now getting PTSD 30 years later as a result of watching the Iraq War on television. It's So in effect, the Iraq War and seeing it on TV is taking these people back to their own personal experiences in Iraq. So this can occur for a very long time. So this is not a problem that's likely to come on the radar, be solved in the next year or two, and then go away. This is likely to be a continuing issue probably for the next 30 to 40 years. So there's a huge opportunity here in analytical studies to get in on the ground and begin doing some of these things. And some of the tools that are available, both the Department of Defense and the VA have electronic health records. So every single person who's an active duty military person has an electronic health record. Every veteran has VISTA. And there's a huge database sitting there already that's virtually untapped for those who have used services in those systems. VA also has a personal health record called My Healthy Vet that can be used by a military veteran to help manage their own health status and health care. That also has not been looked at in this context. And then beyond that, there are additional huge data systems, the Medicaid and Medicare encounter data systems, and some of the state encounter data systems could be used for this purpose. And again, they're virtually unexplored for this kind of a problem. Another whole area here, evaluation studies. Are the clinical interventions working as planned, and what needs to be improved? And I guess I would even broaden that from what I wrote there and say it's not only are the clinical interventions working, it's also are the systems interventions working, and are the programs working? We always do less and less work. We do most of our work about clinical interventions, and I think we do least of our work about system interventions. If you're going to implement a public health model, you really need to get into system-level interventions. You also get into the issue here of field studies versus controlled studies. Obviously, the easiest way to get into this is through field studies, where you would take a cohort of people with a particular set of characteristics and you would track their health status and their service utilization. Much more difficult to get engaged in clinical trials around PTSD interventions, but those need to be done as well. Footnote to that, there is a research program called the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program, CDMRP, the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program, where the Congress appropriates money to do research on issues that military personnel experience, including PTSD. And for this year, they have appropriated, there's available literally right now, $150 million in that program for research on PTSD. Now, we would argue that too much of that money is being spent on basic research. For example, how does PTSD change the structure of your brain versus what can I do about PTSD today? Now, it's not saying we shouldn't do research on the brain, but we also need to have some balance in how we spend our money. And that particular program is biased toward basic research and biased against applied research. But there's a huge pool of money, and that's money appropriated by the Congress that was not requested by the Department of Defense when the Congress thinks that an important issue is available for study. Another area here, family impact studies. PTSD is not only a problem for the returning vet, it's also a problem for family members. And there already are numerous stories of people who've come back where there have been, you know, abuse of children and spouses, there have been murders of spouses or children, there have been many suicides and so on. So looking at this a little more broadly and asking, what is the impact of this on family members? What role can family members play in this process? I think, you know, has a lot of potential. I did just see this week, in fact, that the Army, the Department of the Army, has allocated some resources just very recently to this particular area because they're very concerned about what role the family can play in helping the person deal with these types of problems. And so there obviously will be money made available by the Department of the Army to address this. And a very important statistic that I learned in this process, there are 20 suicides a day in the United States of military veterans. In certain states, and I know only the statistics currently for a couple states like Virginia and Oregon, more than a quarter of the suicides each year are suicides of military veterans. And that's, I think, a statistic that's not really on the radar. You know, mental health, we say we have 33,000 suicides a year. We have an epidemic. We have to do something about it. We don't ever talk about military veterans as part of that process. Now, another whole thing that I think is very important to bring on the table here, I think many of these problems in the past have not been looked at through the framework of public health. And so I think something that's very important that APHA brings to the table and you all bring to the table is bringing that public health framework to the problem. And you can actually get into the issue here. How could you prevent these problems before they ever actually occurred? So as you get into looking at various kinds of population level interventions and individual level interventions, are there interventions that could have been done that would have prevented someone from developing PTSD in the first place? And there are several frameworks for beginning to look at that. There's resiliency theory, and resiliency theory basically says if I can socialize you in a way that makes you a more resilient person in the first place, then I greatly enhance the probability that you will be able to cope with stressful situations later on. Social support theory, the other side of that, resiliency theory is about you. Social support theory is about your environment. One of the reasons the Army is interested in doing the family impact studies is to look at the role that families can play in preventing these problems in the first place. If you not only are in Iraq, but you're loaded with a whole series of other problems here, you know, you're on the verge of a divorce, you've got teenagers who are acting out, you have financial problems, I'm loading you up with a load of problems you're not going to be able to cope with. So what can be done on the reverse side to improve social support so that these don't happen? And then there's also literally 40 years of research on stress theory and eustress and distress that really needs to be looked at in this context for this population. So I guess the point here is we haven't really even begun to apply the public health framework to this. This is something very important to be done. I would argue this is something that APHA should be giving some attention to. What are some of the funding sources for this? I already mentioned the Department of Defense and the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. There's a website for that. I encourage you to go and look at that website. The VISNs and the VAMCs, Services Research Funds. Every Veterans Administration Medical Center has services research money. I'm sure, how many of you have ever had any VA services research money? Any? If you haven't, you need to go and explore it, basically. Well, you need to have you, Joe Morrissey, need to have a close collaboration with somebody in a VAMC who works three quarters or more time. And I think what you'll find in those centers is that they don't have many people like the people sitting in this room. Most of the people sitting in this room have very little connection with those systems. So, again, I encourage you to explore that. Targeted HHS projects. I think what you're going to see out of HHS, you're going to see them out of SAMHSA as time goes on, is more and more focus on this issue and more focus on this population. So you need to watch the grant announcements that are coming out of places like the National Institute of Mental Health, out of places like the National Institute on Drug Abuse and Alcohol Abuse, places like the Center for Mental Health Services and the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, and so on. Projects authorized by states. I think some of the states are getting into the issue here of you know, we as a state, because we have this National Guard, and this National Guard is very important to us, not only because of Iraq, but because of local problems, we need to step forward and do something about this. Again, West Virginia is a potential example of this. So that's a quick, short overview of, I think, you know, the issue from a systems point of view and an epidemiologic and public health point of view. What I would like to do now is generate some discussion with you all about things that could be done to actually move this agenda. And I'm going to come down and sit down here, bring myself up.